You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
the Palestinians and Israelis must work together to reach an agreement that allows both peoples to live, worship, and thrive and prosper in peace. But I would love to be a mediator or an arbitrator or a facilitator, and we will get this done.
How hard can it be? President Donald Trump prepares to set forth to remake the world in his image. My guests Tim Marshall and Jeffrey Howard will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's apparent detachment of American values from American foreign policy, last night's fabulously rancorous French presidential debate, and is it the state's role or responsibility to encourage its citizens to eat better? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. Right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and former diplomatic editor at Sky News, and Jeffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. Welcome both. And we will start in Washington, D.C., where they appear to be able to delay no longer the day on which President Donald Trump is unleashed upon the global stage. Reports from Washington today say he will make his first overseas trip since taking office later this month, visiting Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the Vatican, before a NATO meeting in Brussels and the G7 summit in Taormina. This follows his White House meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, president of portions of Palestine, this week, and Trump's subsequent declaration that peace in the Middle East is, and this is an actual quote, maybe not as difficult as people have thought. Tim, is the world ready for this?
Oh, yes. Quite ready for it. We've had 105 days of it so far, and there's a lot more to go.
About 1,357.
It's a fascinating schedule for what it doesn't do, which is to go to China. It's obviously too soon. And where's Mr. Putin in this? Absolutely nowhere. And so you go to one ally, Saudi Arabia. You then swing round to another ally, Israel. And, yeah, you get to play the great statesman. And, imagine if he pulled it off.
Yeah, look, I doubt it, but you never know. But they're far
apart now, the Israelis and the Palestinians, than they've been for many, many years, and they have been for several years. And so I don't expect much out of that. But, you know, look, you have to encourage people to give something a go. And then on to the Vatican, not very many golf courses there. And then the real business, I think, is at the G7 in Sicily. So he's getting a lot done in one swing round trip. Plays the international statesman, then gets back to what he really cares about, which is the America First.
Jeffrey, do we believe that President Donald Trump is the man to bring peace to the Middle East? People have been trying for the thick end of 30 centuries now. Is he the one who's going to knock it over?
It would certainly be surprising. I mean, it's quite shocking that he's brought this issue to the fore of the current discussion. I mean, with all going on in the Middle East, no one's been talking about Israel and Palestine. And yet there he goes. He brings it up, the most thorny and intractable problem in international affairs. He can only hope to fail. I mean, it's just implausible that he would finally be the person that gets it done when there are so many structural factors standing in the way.
Nixon went to China.
It could work. It could work. And wouldn't Bill Clinton and Tony Blair and Jimmy Carter be upset if it did? I think, as we look forward to this big international trip, the big question everyone's going to be asking themselves is, what is he going to say when he gets behind closed doors with these various political leaders? We know he was on the phone with Rodrigo Duterte from the Philippines the other day, and he just blurted out an invitation to come to the White House. His aides didn't know it was coming. The State Department didn't know it was coming. What might he say behind closed doors? We just don't know.
This is the problem, isn't it? He does seem to have a habit of saying things that come into his head. And Tim, does the world have have to get used to the idea that for the next 1,357 days or so, it is simply not going to be possible to be certain from one of those days to the next what the United States is actually thinking.
Yes, and that is both accidental and deliberate simultaneously, by which I mean it's accidental in that he just can't help himself, and so he just says things off the cuff. He also says things which seem to be off the cuff that are actually thought through in order to throw a grenade into places.
Oh, go on, for example.
And make waves. I am utterly convinced that the phone call to the president of Taiwan, allegedly upsetting 30 years of policy that, you know, you don't talk to the president of Taiwan because it upsets the Chinese, was a deliberately thought-out policy done with Rex Tillerson and others and all the other Taiwan wonks that are in part
of the... See, I hope you're right about that, because that was one of those things I had no problem with. I don't why the president of the United States should not talk to the elected leader
I agree
of
with
another
you.
Democracy.
And when you go through the transition team and you see how many Taiwan experts are in that team, did he really just... You know, he's not a buffoon, but he's not a buffoon. I'll give you another example. There's a book out at the moment by Peter Oborne in this country, and he's examined every single tweet that the president has done in the past 2 years. And he does see patterns.
Peter wasn't paid enough for this.
They're quite funny, some of them. And he detects certainly a sinister trait in him. But he also detects patterns of, yes, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm really hacked off. I'll just fire this tweet off. But other patterns of timed, I'm going to tweet this. I'm just going to put that out there and leave it. He's not a buffoon. Just because you don't like him doesn't make him an idiot.
Well, no, it doesn't.
We've been through this before.
We have been through this before, and I suspect we'll go through it again. Yeah. But Jeffrey, does anybody appear to have cracked the key to dealing with Trump? Several world leaders have met him already. Is he somebody who just appears to respond to groveling and obsequy? Is there any sort of suggestion that he does respect people who stand up to him? Does anybody know what to do yet?
It looks like his MO... with respect to people who stand up to him, is to insult them. Yeah. But he does seem to respond well to flattery, right? Theresa May was flattering Trump by talking about his election win. She described it as stunning, even though he lost the popular vote to his
and
chagrin.
And that's the way to deal with it. Very briefly, yeah. She was the one who, having flattered him, they got on so well he held her hand because he doesn't like going upstairs. She was able to turn around to him at the press conference and say, and of course the president has fully committed to NATO, and... Yes, he has. That was worth all the flattery. Sorry to interrupt.
No, absolutely right. And I think that's consistent with the way other world leaders are treating Trump. So Shinzo Abe, the head of Japan, talked about Trump's golf game. And of course, Trump responds in kind. I mean, he even said during the election that the reason he was saying flattering things about Vladimir Putin is because Vladimir Putin had said flattering things about him. I mean, taking a step back, we really don't want a world in which the fate of global peace and security hangs on the thin-skinned penchant for flattery and being flattered. But I think that's the world we live in.
Tim, returning to your earlier controversial assertion that Donald Trump is not a buffoon, do we get the sense, though, that in terms of foreign policy, he does actually have any grasp on or indeed interest in the actual issues as such?
I think he has a wafer-thin knowledge of the issues and an increasing interest in them. I mean, look, I don't think he's a buffoon. I don't think he's an idiot. I think he is quite childlike, and I think he has a short attention span, and I think he's learning quite quickly just how complicated the world is, and even actually tells us all, hey, I didn't know how hard that stuff was. He tells us, which is also a little worrying. But look at the hysteria that there was before he came into the office. The world has not yet ended. There has not been disasters. I have seen plenty of presidents come and go, and the world, the sky is still up there. Now, I don't think he has a great hinterland and nuance, and thank goodness that he's got people like McMaster, Tillerson, and Mattis around him, because he does genuinely appear to listen to a very small group of people, and those three people within that small group are actually the grown-ups.
Jeffrey, the leader of my own homeland, Malcolm Turnbull, was due to meet with Trump in New York today. I'm not sure whether the meeting has taken place, but if we were able to put you through to Malcolm Turnbull right now, we're not, just so we're clear on this, I'm not setting you up for anything here. What advice would you give him?
Well, I think that Trump and Turnbull have had a very interesting relationship ever since Trump hung up the phone on Malcolm Turnbull.
This was after Turnbull, of course, had to call Greg Norman to get Donald Trump's phone number.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, Trump initially said that he refused to comply with the deal that Obama struck with Australia to take a bunch of Australia's refugees. The U.S. government has since reneged on that and reaffirmed the original promise, which is quite right, too, given how few refugees America actually takes and how little it lives up to its international responsibility. But I think Turnbull should have to go the way of May and Abe and Netanyahu on this and try to flatter Trump, try to strike up a personal relationship with Trump in the way that Xi Jinping of China has done. And then once you have that personal rapport, slowly try to convince him why it's in his interest to do what you want him to do.
When you're dealing with people like Putin and, say, Kissinger, cold realists, it doesn't matter about the chemistry that much. But with an awful lot of people, the chemistry does matter. And it seems to matter more with this guy than any leader in the 20th century we can think of.
Well, let's move along somewhat now, as far as at least as President Trump's Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who has been somewhat more forthright than his boss about what the world can expect of the United States in the next 4 years. Speaking to the State Department, Tillerson articulated an attitude to pushing human rights and American values, which was, depending on one's perspective, an appalling betrayal of everything for which his nation's flag flies, or a refreshing acknowledgement of reality. Tillerson made it clear that, henceforth, values and policies would not necessarily be the same thing. Jeffrey, what did you make of this? Is this actually a dramatic shift in policy, or is he just saying out loud really what America's been doing all along?
So there's a very respectable position that holds that while the United States should stand as an exemplar for certain familiar liberal democratic values, there's only so much that the U.S. can do to promote these values abroad through hard power, either because it's morally unreasonable to expect American taxpayers and soldiers to sacrifice so much to enforce these values or achieve these values abroad, or because it's just unrealistic and infeasible to try to spread them abroad through military might. And so in this view, soft diplomacy is all there is. What's striking here is that the Trump administration doesn't even seem to be committed to soft diplomacy, right? Gently chastising countries for human rights abuses, right? It's not clear that President Trump said anything to Duterte of the Philippines about the spate of extrajudicial killings that have been transpiring there. It's not clear that Trump said anything to Xi Jinping about human rights violations in China. I bet Trump says nothing on that first trip to Saudi Arabia about the excruciatingly horrific human rights violations transpiring there. And this leads me to just worry, is there any moral element to Trump's foreign policy? We have the idea of America first, but we really, but we don't really know what America first is. I mean, if you really believe that we should do whatever's in the best interest of the United States, no matter what the effect is on others, then you'd be committed to using military power to steal resources from foreign countries and enslave foreign populations for the sake of serving American interests. But no one actually believes that. We don't have an articulated doctrine.
I was laughing there because I was very much enjoying Tim's head-shaking, arms-folded thing over there.
Oh, and only the despair in that I agree with everything.
Well, but the thing is, it is correct, is it not, that the U.S., and largely because this is a corner the U.S. has painted itself into, is judged differently in terms of its conducting its foreign policy to every other country. Other country just goes ahead and acts in its own interests, more or less.
Well, the French and the British can occasionally tell the world they have moralizing influences.
But the U.S. has made a huge thing of telling
the world it has
moralizing.
It's a city on a shining hill. It is the example. It does get the huddled masses in.
The thousand points of light.
Yeah. Now, we could give you a very long list, and you could add to it about napalm, about Hiroshima, about Vietnam, about, you know, Abu Ghraib, you name it. But I would still say that the balance would be tipped the other way, with the idea of America being a force for good in the world in the balance, as well as all the problematic things it has done. And it has always at least played lip service and tried. Now, in this world, that's better than nothing. Pay
Indeed.
Lip service and try. And they have. And for example, you can tie aid to a country's policies. I think it's best to do it very quietly, not make a big fanfare and embarrass them, but make it very clear. Look, you carry on torturing, we're going to cut the aid. But I just don't see why Tillerson announced we don't care anymore. Just if you have to behave that way, just do it quietly. Don't announce that we're no longer in the game of morality.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, there might be a play here that says, look, we're better at promoting American values, Western liberal democratic values abroad when we don't say that that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And there's always been an argument that says, well, let's trade with China, even though they don't endorse political and civil freedom. If you give them a taste of economic freedom, then ordinary Chinese people are going to want political and civil freedom too. The jury's still out on whether that empirical claim is right. But
still up to Singapore.
That's well indeed. And I think there is a theory here undergirding this.
Tillerson did do the boilerplate about guiding all our foreign policy actions are our fundamental values, our values around freedom, human dignity, the way people are treated. But he did make it clear that policies and values would not be the same thing. Tim, Samantha Power, the former US ambassador to the UN under Barack Obama, responded, brutal thugs are smiling. Human rights are not only US values. They are universal. Trump / Tillerson approach is green light for repression. Is it really going to make that much difference? Are there sort of dictators and torturers the world over reading Tillerson's remarks and thinking, woohoo?
I think it means that they don't need to factor it in anymore into trade and this, that, and the other. They don't need to worry themselves of even making a pretense of X, Y, and Z. I'll give you I'm just thinking this through while we're talking. Amnesty International's, one of its great rationales is that if it shines a light into a jail cell where somebody disappeared 3 weeks ago, and now we all know, prisoner X is in cell Y on that date. We have shone a light on it. At that point, the regime knows it's going to be very difficult to drop them out the back of a helicopter because, you know, there'll be we can trace it now. But if you go around the world saying, we actually care, it's not a green light. It just means they don't have to try as hard not to kill people. And that's a bad thing. And the other bad thing is that those people that are working for the, I would regard as the betterment of mankind. Most of them, I think, might well be anti-American, but even those that aren't now don't have that sort of something to look up to. At least in the writing of the Constitution and the morals that America is supposed to stand for, because it's very important that they're supposed to stand for, even if they don't always stand for.
No, I agree entirely. But Jeffrey, Tillerson did talk or cautioned against, as he put it, conditioning too heavily that others must adopt this value that we've come to after a long history of our own. Now, weirdly, is he not basically saying there what every anti-American agitator who's wanted the US to stop being the world's policeman has actually been asking for?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. And I think that there is a very attractive idea that America has tried for a long time to be the world police, and it hasn't been especially successful in a range of very familiar cases. But you can reject the idea that America should be the world police while still thinking that America should stand up for human rights. If there's one book I'd recommend people read this year, it's this book called Blood Oil by a guy at King's College London named Leif Fanar. And his basic thought is, look, our own domestic law affirms the idea that whoever is powerful enough to seize the natural resources of a given country, be it blood diamonds in Central Africa, may sell those resources on the international market, and we'll allow that to be put in our mobile phones and we'll sell that in our home country. And his idea is, look, we can agree that we shouldn't go running around the world imposing liberal democracy on everybody, but let's not become complicit in some of the horrible things going abroad by just carrying on and having economic transactions with some of the worst regimes on the face of the earth. And I think this is going to loom large with respect to this trip to Saudi Arabia, because we buy an awful lot of that oil, and this oil is, for all intents and purposes, stolen from the Saudi people. They have no control over this oil, which is their oil.
Okay, well, let's take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Tim Marshall and Jeffrey Howard. Coming up next, what we learned from last night's French presidential election debate, beyond the fact that the two contenders don't much like each other.
How do you take on Donald Trump? In the May issue of Monocle, we head to California, the base of the resistance, to meet the politicians fighting the good fight. We're also in Mongolia for a sit-down with the foreign minister ahead of their elections. We're in Tokyo to take a look inside Uniqlo's new headquarters, Bangkok for its bookstores, Seoul for its fashion, and just south of Melbourne to visit Australia's best-designed hotel. It's our design and property special this month, so we'll bring you a heritage revival in Barcelona, meet some game-changing developers in Warsaw, Oslo and Kuala Lumpur, and we'll tell you which three small but brilliant firms you should commission for your next project. There's lots more, of course, from business to culture, entertaining to fashion. All inside the May issue of Monocle, out on newsstands and on monocle.com now.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tim Marshall and Jeffrey Howard. And it's now 72 hours, give or take, until we know the identity of the 8th President of the 5th Republic. The last two remaining contenders for France's presidency, centrist insurgent Emmanuel Macron and far-right fulminator Marine Le Pen, clashed last night in the final televised debate of the campaign. It was predictably rumbustious, featuring insults both personal and political. Most polls and pundits called it a win for Macron, and indeed polls in general remain much where they have been all along, giving Macron a 20-point lead. Jeffrey, did we learn anything really last night? It did go on for quite some time.
It went on for quite some time. We had some good trades of insults. We had Macron called a smirking banker. We had Le Pen called a liar. And that was a bit fun. But on substance, I don't think we learned anything particularly new. We know that Le Pen's going to engage in mass deportation. We know she's going to try to close the borders. We know she's going to push through some tax cuts, which she's going to fund through some protectionist tariffs. And Macron gave us another case for embracing the EU. So I think we saw a sharpening of their positions, but they're the same positions they've been holding all along.
Now, Tim, is it remotely imaginable that the polls are 20 points mistaken?
This time, I don't think so. I called Brexit right. I called Trump wrong. Said it was be close. But
Brexit was within the margin of error, and so were those swing states in the US.
So I got Brexit right. I said it would be close between Clinton and Trump, but got it wrong because I thought she would win. On this one, I'm afraid I'm more confident. I don't think the French opinion polls are that out of kilter, but it's more than the opinion polls.
They called the first round pretty much spot on.
Exactly. And that is because French society is not a binary in its politics. There are so many parties. And when you look at the 19% for the communist and the 8% for the socialist and then the centrist and then the centre-right, and you add those up and then you start extrapolating. And this is the guesswork, this next bit. How many percentage of that 19% that voted communist will now switch to what they regard as a fascist? How many of the socialists will do that? How many of the centre-right will not vote for the centre? And when you do those maths, you still come down to a 60-40 percent win for Macron.
Including when you factor in how many sanctimonious poseurs who think voting for either of them is beneath them stay home?
Okay, yes. So there are the wild cards, whether how many people just say a plague on both your houses, how many people are actually not telling the truth, how many, it's funny, it's like some of the communist voters are actually go so far into their socialism that they come around to the national bit of socialism, which is where they meet the Le Pen lot.
Far from unheard of.
Exactly. So, you know, I all that said, I'd be extremely surprised. And last night, I mean, it was very entertaining. 2.5 hours. Anoraks like us were gripped by it. All Macron had to do was not lose, because he had to not be absolutely smashed. That could have got a little bit of a wind tail for Le Pen. It was a fantastic expression, an example of passive-aggressive smiling. Never seen so much passive-aggressive smiling. Because all those insults that were being thrown around that you mentioned, when they were saying it, they were smiling at each other. Yeah, trying to be. But it was quite vicious. Le Pen shored up her base. Macron shored up his base. I didn't see anything for the floating voter to decide, you know what, I am ready to vote for the extreme right. That will happen, I think, in the future, in about 5 years' time, unless France's problems are dramatically solved. I think at that point, there will be this sort of exasperated, screw you, everyone, vote. And I think she may have a much better chance next time. I don't think it's ready yet. I think he will win by a comfortable margin.
Tim, Jeffrey raises an uncomfortable point there, which is that if Macron does win on Sunday, as seems likely, how great should the size of relief be that only about 40% of the population of a 21st century European country were willing to vote for somebody like Marine Le Pen, who is far from an old woman and who clearly can come back and have another pop at this 5 years from now?
I think we have great reason to worry. I mean, certainly when we thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election, there were some serious concerns about what will Trump voters do afterward. And I think this will only be intensified in the case of France. People's sense of betrayal, people's sense that they're being run by a bunch of pro-EU technocrats is going to only intensify, I think, if Macron is victorious. And it may well set up the anxiety That could fuel a successful Le Pen victory in a number of years from now. And can you imagine if Macron wins and then there's a terrible terrorist attack and
five years of them.
Well, indeed. And so I think we have no reason, those who believe in liberal democratic values have no reason to relax just because Macron's likely to be victorious.
Final quick thought from you on this one, Tim. If Macron does win on Sunday, is he actually in an extremely powerful position in terms of demanding EU reform, because he can say to the rest of the EU, it's me or it's her. We have got 5 years to keep the Front National out of office and therefore keep France in the European Union and therefore keep the European Union.
Well, I understand the basis of your argument, but he's going to be a weak president. He hasn't got a single MP at the moment.
Not until June.
Yeah,
anyway.
And then he'll have some. It'll probably be a cohabitation government. I don't think it's going to be a very strong government. I also agree with this analysis that there is a democratic deficit issue problem here. Very briefly, the UKIP vote here during the last general election, if it was proportional representation, would have resulted in 40 seats. It resulted in none. I'm not making an argument for UKIP or even for PR. I'm making an argument that those people that voted that way think, what is the point? Where is my democracy? And the Front National, and again, I have no time for them and no candle for them, don't get me wrong, but if you've got 40% of the people, the vote goes for them, and then they realise that the system has closed ranks against them to keep them out, they will also lose faith. I mean, no, that is the system, but it's an issue that is not going to go away.
Well, finally tonight, we will look at a new idea for tackling the definitive first world problem. Obesity is bad for those who suffer from it and bad for society at large, costing fortunes in healthcare. A study by the University of Cambridge has now suggested that offering overweight or obese people 12 months of weight loss classes would prevent tens of thousands of cases of various diseases and, as such, possibly just about pay for itself. Jeffrey, is there any reason why this isn't a good idea?
So it looks like there are three options in the face of rampant obesity. The first is just to do nothing and let public health expenditure balloon. The second is through coercion, so banning hamburgers. And the third is through empowerment, right? And so insofar as we have reason to try to reduce public health expenditure traceable to obesity, and we have reason to help people who want to lose weight, then it seems a no-brainer to go with option three, which is empowerment. I mean, I think some people will complain that this fails to take seriously the idea of individual responsibility, but I think that rests on a mistake. You respect people's individual responsibility when you empower them to do what they want to do, and I think that's exactly what this is likely to do.
Is that what this is doing, Tim? Is it okay for the state to help people who want to help themselves?
Very much so. Whether it's the answer is another thing. I mean, I'm very conscious that what I do nearly all the time is perhaps explain what the problems are as opposed to give the answers what the solutions are, because on that, I simply have no idea. This is a bit of a moral problem as well, when you boil it down, because if it's a nanny state, oh, okay, let's put an extra tax on sugar. We put a tax on cigarettes. Let's put a tax on sugar. Let's put a tax on more tax on alcohol. Let's put a tax on all the things that are unhealthy for us. And I will decide, because I'm king, what is healthy and what is unhealthy. So that route is very problematic, morally, politically. Throwing money at it is very problematic, morally and politically.
Even if you end up throwing less money at it in the long run?
Well, yeah, but hang on a minute. My X, Y, and Z has got this, that, and the other disease and needs treating now, and you're asking me to put all my money into something so somebody won't be too tubby in 10 years' time. I mean, these are all the things that get thrown around, and therefore you do come back to this third route, which is gentle coercion and encouragement. And yes, of course it should be funded more, but so should everything else.
Jeffrey, is there maybe an argument that education needs to start earlier about food and about diet and be more comprehensive? I do have a friend who works professionally in the fitness and health industry who did once tell me that basically it all boils down to eat less crap and take a walk occasionally. But do we do enough? Is it strange that so many adults do appear to go out into the world as grown-ups not entirely capable of looking after themselves?
We totally don't do enough. There needs to be much better education in schools, health education. There needs to be PE. There needs to be physical education where people are out running and learning how to exercise and learning
without anybody winning, of course.
Well, that raises its own can of worms.
Indeed.
But it's, of course, possible to teach kids how to exercise without inculcating a competitive ethos. Not that it's bad to inculcate a competitive ethos, but I think it's also about infrastructure. It's about how we design our cities. Do we design our public spaces in ways that are conducive to people exercising on their way to work, for example? Yeah. Or do we design the infrastructure of our villages and towns such that it's actually really difficult for people to find time in the day?
That's the sort of lateral thinking that I lack. I mean, you know, it's terrific. It does need that sort of broad thinking of other things, because at the moment we are still stuck in the Neolithic age, if I've got my ages right, when we were hunter-gatherers or whatever, whenever we came across something that tasted really nice, we'd eat as much of it as we could because we didn't know when we were going to get the next one. The problem is now, 100 yards later, you see another lovely thing full of fat and unpleasantness, and so we gorge ourselves on that. So yeah, until our bodies catch up, we need to actually perhaps legislate and certainly encourage.
Tim Marshall and Jeffrey Howard, thank you both for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. The studio manager wasn't Toby Hammond. I've just looked up at the production booth. It was Antonio Fernandez. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.